So welcome to the second day of this symposium. And our first speaker today is Jonathan Pritchard from Stanford University.
Great. Well, thank you, Molly, for organizing this wonderful workshop. So today I'm going to be telling you about work that we've been doing on trying to understand the architecture of complex traits. And this is joint work with a number of people. So Evan Boyle is a graduate student in my lab. NASA Synod Armstrong is a graduate student in my lab. Young Lee was previously a postdoc in my lab now at the University of Chicago. And Chuanyao Liu is our collaborator at the University of Chicago. So most of our intuition in genetics has come from thinking about simple and single gene traits. So much of the progress in the 20th century in genetics came from identifying mutations that cause an organismal trait and then doing molecular biology work to understand the links from the genetic variant to how those changed a phenotype. But most phenotypic variation, of course, is genetically complex. So if you think of height, as I'll show you, there's an enormous number of variants across the genome that affect human height. And so I think this raises an important question. What's the molecular mapping from genetic variation to complex traits? If you have many thousands of variants across the genome that affect a trait, what is the way that, like, how do those genetic variants get interpreted by a cell to produce a complex phenotype? So in this talk today, I'm going to start by showing you in the first half several examples of the incredible polygenicity of traits, even traits we might think of as being relatively more simple than something like height, turn out to being extremely polygenic. And then secondly, I'll tell you about our modeling that we've been doing to think about at least one possible explanation for how genetic variation links to complex phenotypes. So to begin with, I'll just start with schizophrenia. So schizophrenia is a disease that we really don't understand very well at the molecular level. There's been an enormous amount of work from many people around the world to perform mapping for variants that affect schizophrenia risk. And in the latest meta-analysis for schizophrenia, using about 250,000 individuals, they identified 108 genome-wide significant loci. So this is an extraordinary accomplishment. A small number of these loci have been characterized molecularly. One of them has been characterized really well, and maybe small numbers of others have been characterized to some extent. However, even though that may seem like an enormous number, together these hits only explain a small fraction of the expected heritability for schizophrenia. It's about 10%. However, if you think, there are estimates of how much of the heritability is accounted for by all SNPs together, and this adds up to about 80%. So there's an enormous number of additional variants that are lurking down here in the bottom of this Manhattan plot that are not genome-wide significant. These have tiny effects, but because there are so many of them, they add together to explain most of what's going on in the genetics of schizophrenia. And so another way of looking at this is in terms of estimates of how much each chromosome contributes to heritability. And this is a plot from Bogdan Pasaniok's lab. The x-axis here shows chromosome size in terms of thousands of SNPs. The y-axis shows an estimate of how much each chromosome is contributing to heritability. And you can see there's a very strong correlation between chromosome size and how much each chromosome is contributing. And this is what you would expect in a model where there's an enormous number of variants. And there aren't variants that individually are contributing huge amounts. There's a small outlier chromosome here, which is chromosome 6. The single biggest hit for schizophrenia is in the MHC region, so you can see that pops off the line a little bit because of that one region. If we contrast this to another trait, this is rheumatoid arthritis. For rheumatoid arthritis, the MHC region is contributing about 20% of the heritability, but that's again on a polygenic background. So if you ignore chromosome 6, there's a clear relationship between chromosome size and how much each of these other chromosomes is contributing. So in work that we've done, we've estimated for both schizophrenia and height that perhaps as many as 50% of haplotype blocks across the genome affect the trait. And this immediately suggests that there must be on the order of around 10 to the 5 causal variants across the genome affecting each of these traits. So you may be saying to yourself, well, you know, height is just an extraordinarily complicated trait. I mean, you could come up with a story for how, you know, essentially any organ system in the body might affect height in some way. Schizophrenia, perhaps, is, you know, something we really don't understand the etiology of. I mean, you know, that's also potentially a really complicated trait. What about something simpler? So we've started looking at the at various biomarkers that have been measured in the UK Biobank data. And so I'm going to show you two examples of this and show you that they're also extremely polygenic. So the first of these is circulating urate levels in the blood. And so this is a small molecule. The concentrations of urate are tightly regulated. In the blood, if you have excess urate, this has leads causally to gout. And I didn't know much about gout before I started doing this, but basically urate crystallizes out to form these needles, which are very unpleasant. Okay, so the UK Biobank has measured urate levels in about 30 other metabolites in 430,000 individuals. And so we can do very well-powered GWAS to study the genetics of this trait. We also started focusing on urate levels because there's a lot that's known about the a priori about the controls of urate levels, in sharp contrast to something like schizophrenia, where a priori we know very little about what's driving that. So first of all, we know a lot about the synthesis of urate. So it's synthesized in this purine metabolic pathway. So so here's uric acid down here, and we know that the genes that drive these molecular steps. Secondly, the regulation of urate levels is controlled by a whole set of known transport genes in the kidneys. So there are transporters that are moving urate in and out of the blood and in and out of the urine to control the levels tightly. Spoiler alert here, the top two hits in the genome are two of the major transporters on this plot. Okay, so we can take urate levels, we can do GWAS for this, and let's do some audience participation. How many genome-wide significant loci do you think we're going to get for a simple trait like urate? You're very shy. Come on, throw out some numbers.
10.
Okay, all right. Okay, so here's the Manhattan plot for urate on a double log scale, and there are 262 genome-wide significant loci. I've compressed the y-axis here, so there are two loci that are significant outliers on this, and those are the two transporter genes I indicated before. But setting aside those two, it's clear that urate is nonetheless a very highly polygenic trait. So we can make the same kind of plot that I showed you before for schizophrenia and for rheumatoid arthritis, looking at urate heritability by chromosome, and once again, you can predict how much of the heritability comes from each chromosome really quite accurately, simply from chromosome size. There's one outlier chromosome, which is chromosome 4, and that's because it turns out by chance both of the major transporter genes are on chromosome 4 in different parts of the chromosome. The biggest hit, this SLC2A9 gene, contributes about 13% of the heritability. There's an additional 8% of the heritability that comes from the second hit, as well as some other key transporters that show smaller hits. But overall, nearly 80% of the estimated SNP heritability is coming in from this polygenic background. And some of the other hits we can interpret. So, for example, there are some transcription factors that are contributing small amounts. But in aggregate, the vast majority of the heritability for urate levels is coming from an enormous number of small signals across the genome. The other point that I want to make is that, other complex traits, most of the heritability is driven by regulatory variants. In the case of urate, it's coming mainly from kidney. So this is a plot of the enrichment of SNP heritability for SNPs in active chromatin compared to genome-wide background. You can see that kidney shows about a 30-fold enrichment, and these other tissues actually show enrichment mainly because of active chromatin that's shared between kidney and those other tissues. So if we condition on kidney, these other signals from the other chromosomes essentially go away. I just want to show you one more example quite quickly. So IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor 1, is another important metabolite protein that's circulating in the bloodstream. It's controlled by known pathway, so in particular RAS signaling pathway controls IGF-1 levels. So this pointer doesn't work really, but. There we go. So IGF-1 gets exported out of the bloodstream by, IGF-1 is involved in this RAS signaling pathway in which it's passing signals into cells through this signaling process. And when we look at the GWAS for IGF-1, we find, in fact, that essentially all of the key genes in the signaling pathway that are really proximal to the IGF signaling at the cell membrane get lit up by the GWAS. However, again, they only contribute a tiny fraction of the heritability. So these main IGF-1 pathways are estimating contributing about 2% of the SNP heritability. So to recap, what I've shown you and in additional work that we and many others in the field have done, we find that heritability is spread very, very widely across the genome as well as thinly. So there tend not to be, for most traits, there aren't enormous effects that drive the bulk of the heritability. Secondly, genes with trait-relevant functions only contribute a really small fraction of the total disease risk or variants for these biomarker kinds of traits. And then a third important point is that the contributing variants tend to be highly enriched in regulatory regions, indicating that most of the heritability is likely flowing through gene regulation. So the question that I want to raise to you then is, what kinds of models can we think about that would explain the mapping from genetic variation in the genome to complex traits? So how should we think about a scenario where we've got perhaps tens of thousands, if not even 100,000 variants across the genome that affect any given trait? This is sort of the goal now, is to think about models that might explain these kinds of data. So in the second half of the talk, I'm going to tell you about the model that we've been working on, which we refer to as an omnigenic hypothesis. So first of all, we suggest that most of the phenotypic variance is driven by regulatory variation in genes that are not proximately involved in the trait in question. Secondly, we propose that essentially, any gene that's expressed in relevant tissues can have non-zero effects on the trait in question. And so the way that we understand this is as follows. So I think of this sort of as a cartoon model for thinking about these questions. So we imagine a partitioning of the genes that are expressed in relevant cell types into two classes. First of all are what we refer to as core genes, and these are genes that have direct effects on a phenotype. And then everything else that's expressed in relevant tissues we refer to as peripheral genes. And these are genes that can matter through effects that are passing through regulatory networks. So if we show a causal diagram of this, we imagine that there's some set of core genes. And so from each core gene, there's a causal arrow that goes to phenotypes that's not passing through regulation of other genes. And so when SNPs are in the... When SNPs that are sister core genes are regulating those, then they can have relatively direct effects. And then SNPs that are elsewhere in the genome have to have indirect effects that pass through peripheral and trans regulatory effects. And so we imagine then that these core genes are sitting inside gene regulatory networks, and the effects of all of the other genes in the, that are expressed in the relevant cell types are passing through weak transregulatory effects onto to core genes to affect the phenotype. Okay, so let's try to be a bit more specific about how this model might work. So first of all, if we imagine a core gene here, and so by definition this would have a causal effect on the phenotype of interest. And now how does SNP variation play into this? Well, so we could have variation in cis that affects regulation of the core gene. So these would be cis eQTLs or cis protein QTLs or in any event, like variations affecting regulation of this core gene. And then secondly, trans effects that are coming from peripheral genes elsewhere in the genome can flow through networks to affect regulation of the core. So first question to ask then is how much of the gene expression variance should we expect to come from cis versus trans effects? And in principle, this is a slightly difficult question to answer because so from eQTL mapping studies, it's relatively easy to find cis eQTLs. These tend to have large effect sizes you can find in modest sample sizes. But trans eQTLs tend to have small effects and they're difficult to detect. However, there's a number of studies that have used different kinds of study designs, for example, looking at heritability and pedigrees to estimate these effects. And so we did a literature review to compile these studies. These are using a variety of different kinds of statistical methods as well as different organisms and cell types. And so these studies all suggest that the bulk of the heritability of gene expression tends to be coming from trans effects. So you can see that the numbers here are ranging across studies from about 60% to about 90% of the heritability is being controlled in trans. So just to put a number on this for the sake of argument, I'll say about 70%. Of the heritability is coming from trans effects. So now we can put some numbers on this plot here. So here we can estimate that if we imagine that core genes are typical of genes in general, then we might expect that about on average about 30% of the heritability is coming from cis effects and the rest from trans. However, as I mentioned to you before, we do know that trans eQTLs must have extremely small effect sizes. So here's an illustration of this. So in this study, in this analysis, what we did was to ascertain the biggest effect size variance for regulating each gene in cis and in trans. And when you do this, you get a winner's curse effect. So what we did was we took those through to a replication sample and measured the effect sizes in the replication sample. And so what you can see here is that the cis eQTLs have systematically much, much, much larger effect sizes than trans eQTLs. And the y-axis here is measured on in terms of the z-score, but what's relevant for the variance is actually the square of that, so that exacerbates that difference even more. Okay, so what I've told you so far then is that we expect that for a typical gene, about 70% of the variance is coming from trans. I've also told you that trans associations tend to be absolutely tiny. And so together this implies that a typical gene must really have enormous numbers of weak trans regulators. And so then if we assume that a typical trait must have, let's say, at least tens of core genes, and each core gene perhaps has hundreds of transregulatory variants, then this starts to explain how it might be that a large fraction of the genome contributes non-zero variants to any given trait. Okay, so that's one part of this. A second part is, why is it that the core genes don't contribute more of the heritability in aggregate compared to the sum of weak trans effects? And so to get at this, we need to develop a simple model. So I'm going to write down basically the simplest kind of phenotypic model that you could probably write down for this. So we're imagining here that there's a quantitative phenotype Y sub I, and we're going to model this simply as a linear model. So Y bar is going to be the average phenotype in the population, and then we're imagining that that we have a sum of effects over core genes. So here, we're taking a sum over m core genes, and then for each core gene, there's an average expression of the population x bar j, and then xij is going to measure the expression of that gene in individual eyes. So here, xij minus xj bar is simply measuring the deviation in each individual of that core gene from the average expression. And then gamma j, gamma j here is going to measure the effect of a unit change of expression of gene j on the phenotype. So basically the way we think about this then is that there'll be some core genes where if you increase the expression of that core gene, that's going to increase your expected phenotype by an amount gamma j, and so conversely for other core genes, maybe decreasing the expression will increase the phenotype value if gamma j is negative. Okay, so now we can compute the variance of this. So now let's see. So here's this expression. So the phenotypic variance, just using simple mathematical properties, there's going to be two parts to this. So first of all, we've got a sum of the variances of xij times gamma squared. Now I told you before that we should think about these variance terms. We can expect that these will be controlled something like a third by cis effects on average. Okay, and about 70% perhaps by trans effects, and we've got m of these terms because we're summing these over core genes. And then, of course, we have a series of covariance effects. These covariances are going to measure the covariance in expression of every pair of core genes. And the important point here is, first of all, that we should expect these covariance terms to be dominated by trans effects. So if you think about it, most of the time core genes are going to be separated in the genome, and so a SNP that affects both of them has to be acting through trans effects, at least in part. And then secondly, the second important point about the covariance terms is that because there's m choose two of these, there's order m squared of these covariance terms. What we need is two things for these terms to dominate. So if the covariances aren't extremely small, and then secondly, if the signs of these gammas tend to line up, then because there are so many of these covariance terms, you can see that these can potentially completely dominate the phenotypic variance. So to show you a simple plot of this, what we're showing here is the percent of the heritability that comes from trans effects in this model. So the x-axis here shows the number of core genes, and then the different lines correspond to different parameter values for how important those covariance terms are. And you can see that the bottom line there is where the core genes are completely independent of one another, in which case about 30% of the heritability is coming from cis effects. But if there's even moderate amounts of covariance among core genes, then the heritability that's coming through trans effects can get up to be very close to 100%. And this really depends completely on the degree of co-regulation of the core genes, as well as whether the directions of their effects, the product of the gammas, tends to line up on average or not. So just to summarize, what I've shown you is that we think that essentially all genes that are expressed in disease-relevant cell types are liable to affect functions of core disease-related genes. Secondly, I've shown you that most of the heritability for typical traits tends to come from SNPs that lie outside of core pathways. So we propose that one explanation for this is that probably most of the heritability is actually flowing through very weak trans-EQTL effects from genes that are not directly involved in the process that we're looking at. And then the last point that I didn't get to touch on is that when we're thinking about organism-level phenotypes like height or diabetes, many of these these kinds of organism level traits are probably often composed of a lot of highly polygenic endophenotypes. So the you know, the urate level example and the IGF-1 example are probably typical examples of sort of underlying endophenotypes. Each of those is highly polygenic in its own right. So you can imagine that if you have a more complex trait like diabetes that depends on a whole series of different underlying processes, then the genetics of those more complicated phenotypes is going to be basically a superposition of all of a whole bunch of individual traits that are already highly polygenic in their own right. We're going to hear next from Guy, who's been working on a related question, which is to understand what the role of natural selection is in these processes. Okay, so let me just thank the key people who've been involved in this, so Evan Yang and Chuan Yao, as well as NASA, and I'll take any questions that you might have.